The National Archives podcast series, Archaeology and Espionage, The Secret Political Life of Professor Veer Gordon Child, presented by Katie Mayer. This talk was recorded on the 15th of April, 2016 at the National Archives, Kew.
Thank you and welcome everyone. Let me begin with a face that's familiar to everyone that studies archaeology. It's the homely face, Professor Veer Gordon Child, 1892 to 1957. He's one of the most eminent prehistorians of the 20th century and an acknowledged Marxist archaeologist. He was known to the public for his excavations on the Neolithic site at Scarabray in Orkney, and largely for two books, one called What Happened in History and the other one called Man Makes Himself. Now, during his lifetime, Child was famous for talking about his admiration for Stalin, his love of Soviet Russia, and he made it very clear to everyone that he was a regular reader of the Daily Worker. But amongst his contemporaries, and to an extent amongst scholars afterwards, there's been a bit of a feeling that this was all talk. Glyn Daniel accused Child after his death of being intellectually dishonest about his left-wing position, and Child's friend Professor Stuart Piggott described his love of communism as an absurd affectation. Now, I have started about a year ago to look again at this question of Child's political life using more up-to-date resources that have become available. And I can say, to start off with, to clear up absolutely all confusion, that it was not an absurd affectation. I can see a clear timeline of the development of Child's socialism and interest in communism. And we can see he was also a pacifist as well. So he began his career probably, maybe partly earlier, but definitely he started during the University of Oxford. He was in the Socialist Society. He had links with the Fabian and the Labour Research Group, and he was a Guild Socialist. He had a brief and well-known career in Australian politics, which culminated in his book, How Labour Governs. He was a member of numerous Communist Front organisations. It was possible he was a member of the Communist Party in 1937 and 1947. He appears on Orwell's famous list of people who could not be contacted to provide pro-government propaganda. He wrote articles for socialist and communist publications, an enormous range of these. He wrote letters to newspapers. He was a keen letter writer. And we can see from the security service files that he acted in pressure groups supporting communist agendas, for example, supporting the visit of a Chinese delegation to Britain. He visited the Soviet Union and numerous satellite countries. And as I mentioned, he was a known admirer of Stalin. He claimed he met him on one visit to Russia. There are hints that he undertook in the 30s covert work for the Communist Party of Great Britain. And we know that throughout his life, he was a pacifist, he was anti-conscription, and he was a war resister in both the United Kingdom and in Australia. And we know that this continued after World War II, where he became a post-war ban the bomb communist peace campaigner. Now, the primary source I've used to construct Child's political life is his security services. Now, he has two security service files, KV2-2148, which is divided in two, and KV2-2149. And there's extracts of this from behind the desk there. Now, what you were looking at and what I've used are copies released in 2005 by the National Archives. For those of you who do genealogical research, these are derived primary sources. A quick word of warning about using KV2 files, if any of you haven't used already. Now, there are hundreds of KV2 files because KV2 were kept on the Secret Service by just about everyone who came to their notice. So it was communists, suspected communist fellow travellers, suspected communist spies, suspected Japanese spies, suspected German spies, suspected renegades, including P.G. Woodhouse, who is listed as a renegade. So there are hundreds of those. Now, many of these have not yet been released, and it's likely that for various reasons they never will be, either because they're not deemed a sufficient public interest or because they're considered too important or too secret to be released. It's important if you use these for bibliographic research to recognise that they are not bibliographic documents. They are the product of routine standardised MI5 procedures. So we have evidence that comes, for example, from opening mail, from tapping phones, from going through rubbish bins, in some cases not in Childs, of actually following people, of looking through their luggage when they're travelling, from monitoring their journeys, checking their passports, going through looking at things they write, so collecting press cuttings, which we can see in the Child file. So it's various kinds of collecting information. But as you do this, you tend to trawl and pull in biographical details at the same time. So this is what it's so valuable about. Now, there are indications, both in Child's file and in some of the other files that are available for you to have a look at, that the subjects of these investigations, in general, knew when they were being watched. There's a lovely illustration of this by the communist Ralph Fox, who wrote a letter to the General Post Office in a very tongue-in-cheek fashion saying, "Could you explain to me why it's taking so long for my mail to arrive at my house?" So there are suggestions they knew. Whenever Child travelled, he put an enormous pillow in his suitcase because he wanted to make life as difficult as possible for those who he knew would be searching his luggage. Another thing to be aware of is if you look at one of these files, you get a kind of index at the beginning of them, and then you get a context listing. And if you look at the index of Child's 2149 and compare it to the contents, they don't match exactly. There's intercepted letters between Child and Dame Margaret Cole in 1954, and they've been either removed or mislaid. It could be that it was felt that it wasn't appropriate to remove these letters relating to Dame Margaret Cole, or it could be they've just been lost as part of the archiving process. Now, Margaret Cole had, by 1980, became a very eminent figure on the left. She was an OBE, and she was a dame. She was a pioneer in comprehensive education and an alderman of the City of London. It may have been felt that it wasn't perhaps a good idea to have that letter open to the public at this point in time. It's never good when you're doing any kind of research whatsoever to rely on just one source to do your research. So I've looked across the range of literature and online evidence available to back up what I find in these Secret Service files. Now, it's interesting to know that there are other files that are kept on Child. We know that there was Australian Secret Service files, including a lot of censorship material kept between 1917 and 1919. We also know, because these are available electronically now, that Child was also had files opened on him in 1951 and 1957. In 1951, the Australian government were taking legal steps to ban the Australian Communist Party, and it's likely that Child was involved in this search of communists that was undertaken in 1951. And in 1957, he returned to Australia, and that's why you have a file there. We know that during the McCarthy era, the FBI had a file on Child, and a scholar used, Leslie White, used the Freedom of Information Act in the late 1990s to have a look at this file. Now, I've noticed quite recently that this is much more accessible to get into the FBI files than it used to be, so I'll hope to go on and look at those FBI files on Child as well. I've also compared Child's KV2 file to the KV2 files of other contemporaries. So I've looked at Robin Page Arnott's, I've looked at Ranjani Palmdutt, who were both key members of the Communist Party, and Raji Palmdutt was a close friend of Child's. I've also looked at that of Ralph Fox, who was a contemporary with Child, and I've looked at those of the Rothstein family, who were very instrumental in setting up the Communist Party of Great Britain in the 1920s. The Rothstein family file are incredibly interested. It's just like reading Joseph Conrad's Secret Agent. Their file is perhaps the most fascinating of all of them. If you want to have a real sense of how secret agents, or people who were suspected of being secret agents, had this kind of game and competition with the secret services, the Rothstein family is the real interesting one to read. But I haven't just restricted myself to these files. I'd looked at other resources as well. Now, the leading biography on child is this one here on the right-hand side, Prehistorian by Sally Green. Now, this is an important biography because she wrote it in the late 70s, early 80s, and she did it using largely oral testimonies from those of child's contemporaries and friends who were still living. So we have material there that we would otherwise have lost and that there is no archive traces of. Now, that is the strength of the biography, but it's also the weakness, because this is memory study and memory is an enormous trickster. We all filter our memories. We remember them differently. Time passes. We forget things. We refocus them and change them. So it's both strong and weak. I've also used Ancestry, which is a fabulous resource you're probably all familiar with, Find My Past. I've used a range of British newspapers because Child became a famous archaeologist. He was reported on in newspapers and he himself contributed letters and articles from newsletters. And I've also looked at contemporary diaries and autobiography. And this picture is that of Virginia Woolf. Her husband, Leonard Woolf, was linked into these socialist networks. And Virginia Woolf met some of Child's personal circle. And we have records of them recorded in her diary, as we do in the diary of Beatrice Webb, who I've also used to do this research. Now, This gives you an idea of how important and interesting these files can be. Now, this is an excerpt from the Australian Secret Service files, and these are almost impossible to read, frustratingly so, all these Australian Secret Service files. Now, in 1957, Child died in the Blue Mountains in Australia, and for a long time until the 1980s, it was believed he had an accident, and it was reported in the newspapers at the time he may have died trying to get a compass bearing. Now, some of his friends, particularly Max Mallowan, husband of Agatha Christie, said no, Child had killed himself because he'd made it an open secret amongst his friends. He was contemplating suicide. In the 80s, his final suicide letter was released through the Institute of Archaeology, and it became clear he'd killed himself. But this letter from this extract from the Secret Service files, which is very close in date to when Child died, makes it quite clear that the Secret Services and the local authorities had a very strong suspicion that Child had killed himself. And they were concerned, the Australian Secret Services, that it was to do with counter-espionage. And you can't read it very clearly, but they're saying, please investigate his death to check it's not to do with counter-espionage. Now, I was wondering why they decided to keep his suicide a secret. And I looked and I found out that suicide had been decriminalised in New South Wales in 1900. So there was no legal reason to keep Child's death secret. But suicide remained illegal in Britain until 1961. And most of his life had been lived in Britain. So I think for reasons of a kind of social attitudes to suicide, and also because of Child's status, they colluded and kept his suicide secret for many years. So how did Child start his Red career? Now, we know for definite he started in Oxford, but I was interested in looking at the Red beginnings. When you look across the range of Child's contemporaries and his friends, who were socialists perhaps from a generation before and who were contemporary with him, you can see a very interesting pattern emerge. Now, many socialists emerge from what we might call an autodidactic tradition. They become socialists through their own reading. Now, Margaret Cole, who was the wife of his mentor, G.D.H. Cole, Douglas Cole, and sister of Raymond Cole, Raymond Postgate, said she became a socialist from her reading. David Blaylock, who was a friend of his, also said the same thing. Cole himself became a socialist because of his love of William Morris. Virginia Woolf tells us that in the Cole's house, there was a bust of William Morris sitting on their sideboard. George Lansbury became a socialist. Now, Lansbury was a great Labour leader and a socialist politician of the generation older than Child. He became a socialist because of the poverty in the East End where he was surrounded, and also the Irish question. They were all mentioned that newspapers were a key element of their development of social thought. And many of them, when you look across the range of them, became socialists in their late teens. So I went out to find out what possibly was influencing Child in his late teens. Now, we know that Child went to university in 1911, and the man on the far left, this one here, is Francis Anderson, who was his tutor. And he was his tutor in philosophy. What is often forgotten about Child is he was both a classicist and a philosopher before he became an archaeologist, and he was a prize-winning philosophy student. He was interested in philosophy his entire life. So Francis Anderson taught Marxist theory as part of his teaching, was a keen advocate of it. So he had influence from Francis Anderson. Now, the man in the middle was his lifelong friend, Herbert or Bert Evatt, who became leader of the Australian Labour Party. Now, he tells us that while at university, Child used to go along to social meetings at Bertha McNamara's tobacco shop, where you used to have gatherings of socialists, small kind of social units where they debated and discussed socialism. And a number of leading socialists in Australia, including the Industrial Workers of the World, used to go along to Bertha McNamara's tobacco shop and hold these discussions. So he's kind of interested, made interested by these discussions. We also know that Child became very interested in the Workers' Education Association, and he was devoted to workers' education his entire life. We can find him promoting workers' education at Oxford, at Scotland, and again when he's director of the Institute of Archaeology in London. But given his lifelong pacifism, I also find it very interesting that in 1911, Australia passed a Military Service Act. Now, the aim of this Military Service Act was to create a kind of people's militia, because Australia was becoming very uneasy about the rise of Japanese power in the Pacific. Now, any man from 18 to 60 could be called upon to serve in this militia, and they also set up a cadet force to support it from age 12 upwards. There was enormous resistance to this in Australia, particularly amongst socialists. And the Australia Freedom League that was set up at this time had 50,000 members. So I think it's also as well to get this balance of ideas. I think Child was promoted and became interested in socialism, perhaps through university, went looking for other socialist groups and developed his thought. And then the trigger that really perhaps pushed him over the edge into pacifism and socialism before he came to Oxford may have been this Australian Military Act. All these forces were kind of acting on him before he came to Oxford. Now, in 1917, having finished with a very high-quality first-class degree at the University of Sydney, Child followed a recognised kind of imperial pattern and came to Oxford. He came to study at Queen's College in Oxford in 1914, and he arrived in Oxford about the time that the war broke out. And it was the First World War that was to really fashion Child into both a pacifist and a socialist. Now, when war broke out, Oxford became deserted almost overnight because many of its students signed up, particularly to join the officer corps. And diaries, not only records of Child's contemporaries, but also of other Oxford students, report how empty Oxford was. It's largely dominated by women for the first time, by overseas students such as Child, and also by those who become very instrumental in Child's life, the socialists who do not volunteer to join the war effort. Now, looking through the papers we have available, we can see that Child became the secretary of the Oxford University Socialist Society. Now, they were dominated at the time by guild socialists, particularly Douglas Cole. And we know, because Child said so himself, he became a guild socialist. He also said in an autobiographic piece of work that he became a member of the Union of Democratic Control. Now, this was dominated by E.D. Morrell and Bertrand Russell, and they wanted to see a negotiated end to the war. And they felt that the war was caused in part by secret treaties kind of gathered together by the great powers. We also know that he was a member of the National Council for Civil Liberties in its earliest kind of existence. He himself admits this. I think, given the pattern of behaviour he demonstrated, that he also became a member of the No Conscription Fellowship. Now, they were set up to protect the interests of those who did not want to fight, who decided that they would not be conscripted. into the army. And I also believe he was a member of the University Socialist Federation, which had been set up largely by the Fabian organisation. And I believe this because others of his friends, particularly Raji Palm Dutt, were very key members of this University Socialist Federation. And this federation led the anti-conscription movement at university. Now, Child first comes to the notice of the security services in 1917. He's at Dorchester Prison, and a prison warder, C.E. Toley, reports back that he has a conversation with a conscientious objector called P.T. Davis, and they say it's a pity that the war has not yet ended and that England has not been starved into surrender and that it hasn't been, you know, and there is no cessation in food supplies. And that obviously the U-boat attacks keeping food supplies have not done the job. Britain is fighting on. Now, Toley hears these remarks, spoken to a conscientious objector, and he's concerned because they sound as though Child is uttering traitorous remarks. So he reports up the change of of command, and these remarks end up on the desk of Sidney Harris, who's secretary to the Home Secretary. And he writes to the man on the left, Edward Armstrong, who is pro-provost of Queen's College, and says, what's all this about? Who is this man? Tell us what you know. And he writes back this astonishing, angry letter to Sidney Harris. And he said, Child is a repulsively ugly. He's probably the ugliest man in the world. And Davis, in spite of his cantankerous and wrongheadedness, has a certain personal attractiveness. And he says the misfortunes of Davis have become a monomania with Child, spoiling and perverting his moral and mental attitude. But he also adds that he doesn't think that Child is a traitor. And he adds that Child had once enlisted in 1914, but his eyesight is so poor that they've decided not to take him. Now, in 1917, Child finishes his degree, and it's time for him to go home. And he applies for a passport to go back to Australia. And these comments come back to haunt him because they've come into the hands of Vernon Kell, the head of the MI5, whose picture is at the bottom. Now, MI5 in the war have enormous power and influence under the terms of Defence of the Realm. They have an almost computer-sized record index of over 1 million record cards. They have, over the course of 3 years of the war, looked into 86,000 allegations and thoroughly investigated 38,000 people. They're turning over an enormous range of suspicious people. Now, because Child is Australian, what happens is the question goes to the man on the right-hand side of Edward Armstrong, which is Major Frank Hall. Now, Frank Hall has been described as a peppery Ulsterman. He's a loyal imperialist, and he was involved in the trial of Roger Casement. Now, Frank Hall has no time for conscientious objectors, and he says and rejects out of hand Child's request to go home through America and look at museums on the way home. And he also says he can go through home through Panama, but he's not to get off the boat in Panama. He's to stay on the boat. Now, this is probably because Child is considered perhaps a dangerous influence. They don't want him going off the boat in America, potentially as both a pacifist and a guild socialist, influencing American workers. And America has just entered the war on the side of the Allies. And similarly in Panama joins World War I on behalf of the Allies the day after America. They don't want him upsetting anyone in Panama after. But Hall is known to have a somewhat dark humour, and it has been claimed by some that he is the model for Ian Fleming's Q. And he also says, if Child is so concerned about submarines, we'll send him home the long way, and there's a chance that he himself might get sunk by a submarine. And this actually was very dark humour, because in 1917, the German Navy had declared all-out war, both on British shipping and international shipping in British waters. And until they get the convoy service going across the Atlantic, crossing the Atlantic is a very dangerous and risky thing to do. Who is P.T. Davis that has so much influence on Child? Now, no one has gone looking for P.T. Davis, but I felt it was important, if this man is so influential on Child, to find out who he is. Now, using the power of ancestry, I managed to identify him as Philip Taliesin Davis. His dates are 1895 to 1937, and he was known to his family as Tal. Now, Tal was the youngest of a family of six, and he had five sisters, Layla, Eulalie, Marjorie, Kathleen, and Lalage. Now, most of the information I can find on the Davis family comes through the Eulalie link. Now, Eulalie marries Tom Heron, who is quite an influential Christian socialist and owner of the Cresta Silk Factory. Now, Heron reports that this family were the children of a Congregationalist minister, Michael Davis, who had congregations first in Bradford and also in Bolton. Now, Davis was a violent pacifist. He was very pro-Boer, so much so that he refused to let his children stand up for the national anthem at the height of the Boer War. And it so incensed the local populations that his church windows were broken because of his attitude. So the children were all brought up to be pacifists. And Armstrong says that child is familiar with the whole family. And when we look at Tal in more detail, we can see what is particularly important about him. Now, amongst the documents made available to the general public is a site called Lives of the First World War. And uploaded onto the Lives of the First World War is Professor Cyril Pierce's register of conscientious objectors. Now, there are about 16,500 conscientious objectors in total in World War One. But only about 1,500 of them were what is known as absolutist. Now, absolutist conscientious objectors refused to do any kind of alternative service whatsoever. They refused to work in ambulances. They refused to do work to support the war effort. So they were imprisoned. Now, Cecil Pierce's record gives us a profile of Tal. So he is about as definite a conscientious objector as it's possible to be. He's an absolutist. He says he's international socialist. He's a member of the No Conscription Fellowship. And we can see what is known as a characteristic cat and mouse pattern from these events. We can see Tal is drafted. He's arrested because he refused to be drafted. He's carted off to a military barracks where he refused to put on uniform. He's sent back to a tribunal. He's imprisoned. He's held for a period of time. He's let out again. And the process starts again. It's a process known as the cat and mouse. So we can see he went to prison several times. He went to Wandsworth. He went to Wormwood Scrubs. He went to Dorchester. He went to Hull. So he goes to prison for his beliefs on several occasions. This is, I think, why Armstrong reacts so strongly to the link between Child and Tal Davis, because Tal Davis is about as offensive to those who were supporting the war as it's possible to be in 1914 to 1918. He's refusing any kind of military service. Now, we can see how behind Tal and how loving Tal's family were from letters which are available in the Europeana website, which were put up by Tal's daughter, Bridget Davis. Now, these are letters between her aunt, Layla Davis, and Joseph Dalby, who becomes the husband of another sister, Kathleen. And she describes the family, you know, the close family's reaction to Tal being arrested. And it's a very interesting letter to read, and it gives you a really strong sense of how committed and behind Tal his entire family are. And these give you an idea, these posters at the time, give you an idea of what people thought of conscientious objectors. You know, the general public did not think very much of conscientious objectors at all. Now, Tal Davis was not the only conscientious objector amongst Child's immediate friends and social acquaintances. Now, we know that almost all his friends in the Socialist Society of Oxford were also conscientious objectors, and many of his friends in the Labour Research Department were also conscientious objectors. Now, Beatrice Webb funded the Fabian Labour Research Group, and she protected some of these, as did the union movement. But she protected them, but her feelings were ambiguous about their refusal to serve. So we have this lovely diary entry of Beatrice Webb 3rd March 1916. We are watching with amusement the three young men who are the colonel of the Fabian Research Department struggling to escape the net of conscription. Cole, Mellor and Arnott are pleading conscientious objection, also work of national importance. Disapproval of violence is certainly no part of their creed. They were always preaching violent action on the part of the manual workers before the war. What they detest is being forced to do anything that they don't like, especially being forced to do it by a government they abhor. They are not conscientious objectors. They are professional rebels. In spite of this, Beatrice protected Mellor and Arnott and Alan Kay, who was another friend of them. And Cole was protected by the Associated Engineers Union. He found refuge there. So they did protect conscientious objectors within the socialist left. Now, Tal Davis's life does not end up quite so well. He's not protected. Like all conscientious objectors, when he comes out of prison, which is in 1919, he's disenfranchised for 5 years. He cannot vote for 5 years. He cannot finish his degree at Oxford, and he cannot find work, particularly in education. So his brother, Tom Heron, takes pity on him, and he becomes manager of the silk factory of Cresta in Welwyn Garden City. Now, no picture known of Tal survives, but I think Tal is the man in the grey suit in the middle. Just here. Right, that's Tal Davis. Now, the Davis family's legacy of pacifism continued. Now, Tom Heron's son was the great post-war artist Patrick Heron, and Patrick Heron was himself in the Second World War a conscientious objector, and Patrick Heron was also one of the founding members of CND. So the Davis family tradition continued not only with Tal, who died in 1937 in a flu epidemic, but also through into another generation, into Patrick Heron. Now, the friendships that Child made during this period of time were to remain very influential throughout his life. Raji Palmdutt, an important member of the Communist Party, and his brother Clemens were close friends. Raymond Postgate, who began, he was for a while a member of the Communist Party, was another close friend. David Blaylock, who went on to work for the United Nations, was another good friend. John Langdon Davies, who set up an important foster charity, was also important. Margaret Cole, Daisy Lansbury, Gilbert Murray, George Lansbury, and other familiar socialists and communists were also influential. One who is lost to us is Alan Kay. Now, Alan Kay committed suicide in a suicide pact with a friend in 1919. He gassed himself in another mutual friend's gas oven in the flat. Alan Kay is, I think, one of these lost influences on people that we sometimes find emerge in history, but we lose them. They're elusive. Kay was actually arrested in 1915 for passing information that was felt to be injurious to recruiting, and it made all the national newspapers, and he went to prison for doing this for about 2 weeks. Now, he's interesting because up to 1914, he was Alan Kaufmann, and his father was a Jewish-German refugee. And the family lived in Liverpool. His mother was a member of a Liverpool Jewish family, and the Liverpool Jewish community had a very strong socialist element to it. So I think Alan Kay was one of those hidden influences, not just on Child, but on this whole group of friends. Now, Child's suicide, we're told by Ramus Bosgate's son, John, devastated that social circle, but none of them doubted for a moment that Kay had the right to kill himself if he so chose to do. And in fact, Daisy Lansbury actually went on in the 1970s to also commit suicide after the death of her husband. So I find it interesting to note that three of this immediate circle, including Child, committed suicide, and they obviously felt that they were entitled to make this choice. Red Australia. Now, in 1917, Child returned to Australia, And we know a lot about his political life in Australia. It's been very extensively studied by Australian academics. We know a great deal about this, not only because of the research they've done, but also because he was watched so carefully by the Australian Secret Services. Just about every letter he ever wrote fell into the hands of the censors, and we have a copy preserved within the archives. So we know that he was known to the Australian Secret Services before he came back to Britain, because he announced his opposition to the war in a student magazine. And then we know he went through a pattern of getting jobs or trying for jobs and losing the job because of his conscientious objection stance. So he starts off by having a good job as a residual tutor at St Andrew College in University of Sydney, but he loses that job because he's anti-conscription. He doesn't get a tutorship in 1918 for the same reason. He gets a classics mastership at a school in Maryborough. When the local community find out he's a conscientious objector, there's an enormous kind of outcry that he's allowed to teach their children, and he's forced to leave the school. And in the end, he gives up trying to get a job in education, and he becomes a clerk in the state land tax department, what he describes as experienced wage slavery under state capitalism. We have to see Charles' political activities within the general context of Australia at this time. Now, the historian Joan Beaumont has described World War I Australia as a broken nation. Our most familiar image of Australia during World War I is Gallipoli and the heroism of the Anzac, which become kind of central to the emerging Australian myth of themselves. But there was also a very strong opposition to conscription. And you can see the results of the referenda. They'd had two referendas against conscription, and in both cases, conscription was narrowly beaten by an incredibly narrow margin. Now, Beaumont looks at the kind of the range of newspapers, social histories of the time, and she says that this question of conscription broke Australian society. It divided it. You can see it from particularly in local small towns where people having almost family battles amongst themselves over the question. And she says it was a shadow that hung over Australian society beyond World War I. It took a long time to resolve. So it's important that we don't necessarily see Child as a victim. We have to see Child also as an activist. And there's no doubt about this. Now, one of his allies, who was a journalist, in 1924 wrote this very interesting comment on him. He said he was a staunch rebel fighter during the stormy wartime period. Hats off to him for his stance at the university and the good work he did by precept and example during the time he was associated with what this person terms the rebel movement. Now, he came out strongly in support of the industrial workers of the world, who had been banned in Australia in 1914 because they were considered a dangerous influence, and 12 of their leaders had been imprisoned. But we can see Child from the Secret Services files over here. Child's up to other activities when he's in Australia. Now, he's sending back and exchanging with Rajani Palmdutt through a third party articles for the socialist newspaper Labour Leader. Now, it was illegal to export Labour Leader during this wartime period because it was felt, again, injurious to the war effort. So they're obviously trying to find ways around this. And we also have this very intriguing little paper trail in Child's file where they're investigating him in association with an Egyptian, Mohammed Amin el-Biblawi. And they want to know why Biblawi and Child see to be in correspondence with one another. And somehow or another, Palmdutt is involved in this as well. And although they don't make it clear why they're concerned about this little interaction, it is interesting to note that Child and Palmdutt were also lifelong anti-imperialists. And Egypt and India, there was kind of concern about both these countries within the empire at this period of time. And in 1919, there was enormous revolt in Egypt against British rule. Now, when I first looked through these documents, I wondered whether Biblawi was a pseudonym that was being used by Palm Dutt. Now, this is something that when the Communist Party develops, we can see that was used to pass information and letters under the kind of undercover and away from the secret services. They used pseudonym and they used front addresses and organ, you know, and individuals to pass letters to one another so the secret services won't find them. But I did look more closely into Biblawi, and he was a genuine person. He was a medical student at Guy's Hospital, and he graduated as a doctor in 1922 and returned to Egypt and continued to practice as a doctor in Egypt till 1947. So he could have been involved in the kind of anti-war movement, or he could just have been an innocent person that made friends with them and was used to pass information. It's one of those things that arise from these files that you can never really resolve. Now, in 1919, Child made what seems to be a remarkable transition from being a renegade conscientious objector to the private secretary of John Storey, the prime minister. And between 1919 and 1921, he held this role. In 1921, he returned to Britain ostensibly to look about how he would set up a research organisation back in Australia. And we have this lovely little story, little kind of snapshot of Child as a private secretary. It says, at the top of the stairway, a rough and tumble deputation, evidently representing a branch of some housewives association, and still more evidently determined to see the premier by hook or crook, relative to some abstract matter such as the price of potatoes, clamoured for admission to his private sanctum. And in the middle of the excited throng stood Gordon Child, striving to make his measured classroom voice audible above the medley of high-pitched feminine cackle in a vain effort to coach them back to their home by vague allusions to some more convenient day. His homely features wore registering despair, but I knew deep within his soul registered disgust. What did the price of potatoes matter to Gordon Child? It was the cheapness of flesh and blood that stirred him. Bah, a pack of female Neros fiddling while Rome burned. Now, what this is saying is basically that Child had made the transition to mainstream politics, which was also made in this country by other conscientious objectors, but it really wasn't radical enough for him. So he came back to Britain looking for perhaps more radical politics. And this is a period of time for which we know very little about Child's career. It's almost like a red hiatus. Now, there's an enormous mystery surrounding the question of whether Child joined the Communist Party in 1921. And the file gives us a little trail and then goes cold. So we have this little information here saying, investigate Child. He's an extreme socialist. He's closely connected with Postgate. We want to know whether he's taking part in this revolutionary movement. And then when you look through the Child file, you've just got a couple of pages saying Postgate, Postgate, that suggests stuff's been removed from it, associated with Postgate, and our trail goes completely cold. Now, this suggests there may have been a KV2 file on Raymond Postgate. Now, Raymond Postgate joined the Communist Party in 1920 and then became frustrated by Russian control of it and left a couple of years later. He became a very respected left-wing journalist and author of The Good Food Guide, for which he's most famous. He had an interesting past. One of his friends described him as one of nature's dissenters, which is a very interesting way of looking at him. And then we seem to have a complete change of lanes in Child's life. He produced the book on the left, How Labour Governs, which is an enormous attack on the left-wing government of Australia, which is why he's of such interest to Australian scholars. And then he changes completely and he produced what's widely regarded as his masterpiece of archaeological writing, The Dawn of European Civilization. Now, this sets him on his path as an archaeologist, and it is the dawn that really makes his career. When I look through our library archives to find out what I can find about the history of the library, people write from all over Europe after World War II wanting Child's books. And it is this book, The Dawn of European Civilization, that they all want. So this really makes Child's career. So much so that in 1927, Child is appointed to be Abercrombie Professor, the first Abercrombie Professor of Archaeology in Scotland. And he seems to be descending into a life of respectability and prosperity. And we know that he became incredibly fond of cars at this time. He was notoriously fond of cars, but he was also renowned as an awful driver. No one who got in a car with Gordon Child ever forgot the experience. He was so bad as a driver. So he wrote this lovely letter to Rajani Palmdart in 1941. "My dear Raji, I was awfully bucked to hear from you again. The only one of your colleagues I meet nowadays is Alan Hutt, and that rarely. As you see from the notepaper, I've become bloody bourgeois, at least externally. And Child was a great joiner of clubs, and I think this one was written from the university club. He joins the Athenaeum. He writes proudly to people from the Athenaeum. But what I find interesting about this is Alan Hutt is a leading member still of the Communist Party. And they're obviously holding on to Child, because when you look at Rajani Palmdutt's KV2 file, there's a kind of a supposition written by an agent in there which looks at the official management structure of the Communist Party. And there's a kind of shadow management structure of the Communist Party, which that they will take over if the main kind of formal acknowledged structure are ever imprisoned. And this is a common pattern that developed from the ways that suffragettes used to arrange their organisations in this way. Sinn Féin in their early days also had an official management kind of structure and a shadow one. So I think they're not quite letting go of Child. They've got hold of him just in case they need him. But a friend of him said he kept aloof of political rallies. He didn't take in part in any party politics in Edinburgh. And when you look across the range of Child's publications through these years, it does seem very much that he's abandoned politics completely. From about 1924 to 1931, he's on the road away from politics and on the way away from the left. And he becomes famous in Scotland, largely because Scarabray, because of these excavations in the Neolithic. Now, Anne Bridges writes a kind of Mary Stuart-style mystery story involving an archaeologist, which she dedicates to Gordon Child, called And Then You Came. And he appears regularly in Scottish local newspapers. You know, he's here, there, everywhere. He's lecturing here, he's talking here, he's talking on the radio. He has a car accident in 1929, which surprises no one who knows he's driving. And it's reported not only in the local papers, but the car accident even makes it into the Manchester Guardian. You know, professor has car accident, which is pretty remarkable nowadays. So he has this kind of respectability and fame building up. But what we do see is, at the same time as the shadows of war begin to gather, we have an enormous upsurge in activity. And it starts in 1931. And interestingly, this is the time in which Rajani Palmdart, who'd been such a good friend of him at Oxford, comes back to Britain from abroad. And we can see this build into a kind of crescendo round about 38 and 37. So in 1931, he starts to contribute to a Marxist theoretical journal. And then he becomes, in 1933, president of the Edinburgh branch of the communist-controlled USSR Scottish Society. 33, visits Japan. 35, visits the USSR. 1936, starts his peace activities up again. Joins the Left Book Club. Then we see him on some very interesting ship journeys that I'm going to explain about a little bit in more in detail later. So he's 1936, he's on a ship going perhaps to Spain, perhaps to the East Indies. He's become chairman of the India League, takes on the economic support of Gerhard and Maria Bersu, who are archaeologists fleeing from the Nazi regime because they are of non-Aryan descent. He takes on the editorial committee of the Marxist Quarterly. 1937, the chief constable of Glasgow claims that Child is a communist. We have no way of substantiating this, but he's the chief constable, and this is what he believes. In 1937, he's investigating the Spanish consul in Scotland for the Communist Party of Great Britain. He refuses to attend an international congress of the Archaeology Institute in the German Reich, which may be linked to his hatred of the Nazis. Child and Bersu are investigated by MI5 in 1940. He supports a left-wing Allies Inside Germany exhibition in 1942, and he also founds the Edinburgh Association of Scientific Workers. So suddenly, out of nowhere, we have this enormous communist red profile develop. Now, the reason for this, I think, is the rise of fascism, perhaps more than the Great Depression. Now, 1931 was when Japan started to invade Manchuria, and most of Europe took notice but didn't really start moving in terms of activity. But Child is Australian, and Australia has this long-term fear of Japanese activity, and I think he's very aware of it. And then we have the Spanish Civil War, which you can see at the top right-hand corner. We have Mussolini and Hitler looking extremely cheerful there on the left. We have Oswald Mosley, who emerges in Britain in the 30s in his black shirt. And at the same time, we have the enormous poverty that follows on from the Great Depression. Now, Child is in Scotland, and Scotland in particular is very hard hit by the Great Depression. However, I look at the evidence I have of Child, and I think Child is much more of a political socialist and communist than he is a social socialist and communist. I can't find any writings or letters written by Child that in any way talk about his concerns about the poverty and social inadequacy around him. He's much more interested in politics and kind of peace politics. He's much more political. He joins the Left Book Club. Now, thousands of people joined the Left Book Club. It was set up by Victor Gollancz, and it became a very influential meeting at the time. But for some reason, the Secret Services are worried that he's joined the Left Book Club. So they start to investigate him for joining the Left Book Club. Now, the Left Book Club is, you know, a standard book club, but it has a strong left-wing element. We can see books by Haldane, who is a known communist, and Orwell, who was, until the Spanish Civil War, quite a supporter of the Communist Party, but then afterwards, not at all. Why are they interested in Child? Well, we have some interesting little records kept when they open the mail of internal communications within the Communist Party. They say he's an important fellow. It's good to keep on good terms with him. He's a man of status. So Child's fame, which has been building during the 1920s, is of use to the Communist Party. He's the kind of man they want for their front organisations. But Child, at the same time, is kind of playing a little bit of a double game. It looks as though he's supporting and cooperating with the Communist Party, but he writes this letter to his friend Raymond Firth, and he asked him to look over an article he's writing for the Plebs League. And he kind of writes in this letter, his handwriting is quite difficult to read, but he's quite scathing about the Communist Party in this letter. So he's famous, Child, for saying one thing to one person and another thing to another. And this letter really shows that the Secret Service documents suggest he's really committed and he's there with these front communist organisations. But his personal letters suggest perhaps he's a bit more tentative than we might accept. So we need to be careful with these Secret Service files, not to take them too literally. Then we have these interesting hints about Child and the Spanish Civil War. Now, when I looked at Child's journeys on Ancestry, I thought, let's have a look and see where he's travelling to. We're going to find anything. And I found two very interesting journeys, one on Find My Past and one on Ancestry, both on the same ship, this Marnix van Sint Aldegonda. Now, one says that in April, he stops off at Palma de Mallorca in Spain, just before the Spanish Civil War breaks out. And the next one says he's off to the Dutch East Indies, which we know he went to. Now, the spelling on one of these is a bit questionable, and it's possible that the record keeping on the shipping line is not that great. But I find the presence of Child here in 1936 extremely interesting, as I do the presence of Child in Japan in 1933. Now, the poet Stephen Spender was sent to Spain by the Communist Party around about this time to try to find a ship that had gone missing. And I wonder whether Child is also travelling to perhaps get some information for them. Now, in 1937, a man called David Mackenzie says they suspect the Spanish consul in Edinburgh was a fascist, and they were having investigated, and they named Child as this man. Now, David Mackenzie was an ambulance driver in the Spanish Civil War, so I know he was a committed socialist and very committed to the cause and the you know, anti-fascist cause in the Spanish Civil War. And he's also described in 46 later on as an undercover member of the Communist Party and extremely active in party matters Spanish. Now, perhaps the background to this is this man here, who is the Spanish archaeologist Busch Quimpera. Now, Busch Quimpera became a leading member of the Republican government of Catalonia during the Spanish Civil War. And when that all fell apart, he was forced to escape to exile in Mexico, and the two men were friends. So we have a link in also as a personal level. We know that he was also, during this period of time, active in peace campaigns. Now, this information came solely through newspapers, so never ever dismiss newspapers as a really good way of looking for research. So I can find that he was, from 1936, a member of the Dundee Peace Council, which was a kind of set of organisations who were really keen to promote peace during this really difficult time. They sent a delegate to the International Peace Congress in Brussels. They have a representative of the Scottish Peace Council, and they have an exhibition in the Glasgow Herald, tells us, in the Empire exhibition. We also see from another newspaper article that he was a member of the Cambridge Anti-War Group. And as a member of the Cambridge Anti-War Group, he even goes so far as to say in 38 that whilst he doesn't agree with the government, their peace at any price policy perhaps is the way forward. So he really is committed to the idea of peace. And then we have, in the war breaks out, and we have some lovely, amusing correspondence between that is kept in Secret Service files when they're monitoring Child's correspondence with Bersu. Now, Bersu is German. He's been exiled to the Isle of Man, where he spends his time doing important archaeological excavations. But they're opening his mail because there is concerns about him because he's German. We have this lovely letter that's written by Maria, you know, an exchange with Child, and is saying, they're talking about cheese. He's sending them cheese, and the security services are monitoring the exchange of cheese. As an archaeologist, what I particularly love is the fact where it says Goldberg Querns. And anyone who's an archaeologist goes, oh, that's not how you spell Querns. So it's a lovely, you know, you've got Goldberg Querns. And it is just one of the things that researchers say who work on these files is the fact that so much time seems to have been wasted in these security files, watching people do utterly mundane things. And I think this is a superb example of it. But is it? Now, another one of these letters investigates Child on the Orkney Islands because they don't want someone of his red complexion near their gun emplacements. And there's a major one at Ness on the Orkney Islands. And Child is perhaps up to things that we don't know about. Now, during the Second World War, Child was travelling around the Highlands area, making desperate records of all the monuments there before they were destroyed in some cases by army action. The Polish forces had blown up a monument, and there was a great outcry over this. So he is travelling around recording them in case the army destroy them. So he's in a military zone. And Angus Graham, who travelled around with him, said at one stage, Child said that he was being monitored by the security services, and he travelled a day out of the Highland zone to post a letter because he didn't want the security services to read that letter. And in the Child archive, there's very little of anything political or anything personal, but there's this very fascinating letter which suggests that he's exchanging something with the Russian Soviet embassy. And here we have Zonov, who is the second secretary to the Soviet embassy. Now, my colleague Leslie Pittman, who is librarian of the School of Slavonic and East European Studies, has translated the Russian for me, and she says it's a list of books relating to the archaeology of Azerbaijan and Uzbekistan. But what is it that he's sending them is the big question. I'm fascinated by this because in Ralph Fox's KV2 file, they are tracking Fox at one stage because they think he's passing on information for Portuguese communists to the British Communist Party. Now, in 1944, we were supposed to be friends with the Russians. We were allies together. And in the Imperial War Museum, there's a photograph of Zhonov proudly presenting certificates in proficiency in Russian to local school children. So it could be that this is just a purely cultural link between the two of them. But I find that fascinating. Now, Child went through the Child Archive before he killed himself and took out anything that was not archaeological. But he was famously a keen practical joker. And I wonder why he left this letter in here. It's almost like a practical joke on the future. Keep us all guessing. Let's finish up by just looking at his activities when he came to London. He became director of the Institute of Archaeology in 1946. And he was very happy in the Institute. He was very close to Max Mallowan, who was the husband of Agatha Christie, who is here. Sent to Agatha Christie. He was also very close to this man, Edward Pidock, who was secretary to the Institute of Archaeology. They were good friends. He was much loved by his colleagues at the Institute of Archaeology at the height of McCarthyism, when they were concerned that the British might follow suit and sack anyone who seemed to be associated with the Communist Party. Rachel Maxwell Hislop, who was one of his colleagues at work, said they all agreed that if they were going to sack Child, they would all resign at the same time to support him because they loved him so much. And here we have a very interesting pattern emerge. Now, in the 50s and the late 40s, he very much becomes a leading figure of these communist front organisations. Now, not every single person who joined these organisations was a communist or interested in communists. But as one of my colleagues said when I gave this lecture at the Institute of Archaeology, it's one thing to join one of these organisations, but to join 15 is something else completely different. And we can see a whole list of them. Communist Party Historians Group, Executive Association of Scientific Works, Vice President of the Marxist Memorial Library, National Council for Civil Liberties, Hampstead Peace Council Delegate, Daily Worker. He's doing so much important work for these front organisations. He's most famous for working with the Communist Party of Great Britain Historians Group, Christopher Hill and Eric Hobsbawm, who were famous, and they produced the journal Past and Present. Now, for a long time, it was thought that all evidence relating to Child's involvement with them had vanished, but there are hints of this in the Communist Party of Great Britain's archive, and there's some minutes of some meetings they have, and Child is obviously present, and he's told to go away and rewrite something he's written on R.G. Collingwood's philosophy because it's not read enough. It's not in keeping with the party line, which is very interesting. He's been told off and told to go back, eminent professor, and do his homework again. So what did he bring to these groups? We have two very interesting ideas. Burns said that if they were not so terrified, he would have Gordon Child. Now, this is a record of a conversation that was a phone tap, but he was not in the party. And here we have this ambiguity. Sometimes he's saying he doesn't like the Communist Party, but he supports them in everything we do. And they say he's like the Dean of Canterbury with a different outlook, but with an absolutely sincere and sympathetic approach to the party. Now, the Dean of Canterbury was Hewlett Johnson, famously known as the Red Dean of Canterbury. He was a keen supporter of the Soviet Union. Max Mallowan also had a very interesting take on this. He says the party were too clever ever to admit him formally. Outside it, he was an invaluable ally. From in it, he would have been a menace. And there's always this uncertainty about whether Child actually ever joined the Communist Party. There are indications that he joined it perhaps in 37 and perhaps again in 47, but no one's certain. I can't find that even the Communist Party was certain that he'd joined them. Now, Leslie Pittman, my colleague in CIS, tells me that this was not an unfamiliar pattern with intellectuals. Some of them did join the Communist Party for a while and stayed with the Communist Party. Others of them left and came back or left for good. So it was kind of part of this intellectual relationship with the Communist Party. And we know that he remained a very keen ban the bomb peace campaigner after 1950. And we know this because there's a letter preserved in the Secret Services files from W. Fagg, who was an eminent curator of African collections down at the British Museum. And he writes in a very grumpy fashion that Child has hijacked the membership list of the Royal Anthropological Institute and sent them all a request to sign the Declaration of the Stockholm Peace Campaign, which is a communist peace organisation. And he's actually, quite clearly, this man, an informant for the government. So he's keeping an eye on all the things that are going on. And he also writes that he hasn't challenged Child about it directly, but he has written to the Manchester Guardian and complained that Child's done it. So you see these games they play with one another using the newspapers. And we know that he appeared on Orwell's list. In 1949, Orwell produced a list for the government of people who he did not feel could be trusted to produce propaganda for the government. It included Charlie Chaplin, Hugh McDermott, Naomi Mitchison, and Gordon Child. Now, what is not widely known is that Orwell and Child met in 1942, and Child worked on a radio programme for the BBC with Orwell. So people have often said, why is Child on Orwell's list? How did that turn up? And I'm able to say they did meet, and it's probably a conversation they had in 42 made Orwell aware of his sympathies. What I find fascinating is why he's doing all of this for the Communist Party. He still maintains this mainstream establishment figure. And he appears on Animal, Vegetable, Mineral on the 3rd of May 1956. And you can actually watch this through the BBC archives. So you can see Gordon Child walk and talk about archaeology. And I find this very useful as a biographer to do this. One thing I think you have to be very aware of when you do family history or biography is that you don't own these people too much and you don't project yourself on them. So I watch this clip of Child regularly to remind me of what he was really like. He's not my imagined version of Child, so I get a kind of a filmography view of Child. Now, I love this because what we have here is Mortimer Wheeler, who'd fought in both world wars, and a keen, enthusiastic imperialist. In the middle, we have Shana Riordan, who is professor at Dublin. Shana Riordan was trained by Adolf Marr, who was a Nazi in Ireland, the leading Nazi in Ireland. And then on the end, we have Gordon Child. And what they're handling is material from Prague. And the reason they're handing this material from Prague is the BBC is exercising its soft power and trying to influence Czechoslovakia and kind of try to work against the kind of Soviet government in Czechoslovakia. So he's almost now at this point being a stooge almost of the BBC. So to end this all, let me end by saying, what do we know from Gordon Child's KV2 files? Child was not a spy. He was, throughout his life, with perhaps a brief hiatus, a very enthusiastic left-wing activist. He was a source of concern to the Secret Services as a potential agitator. This started with him being a student agitator. But when his status rose and he became an eminent professor, he became more dangerous and more influential. The Communist Party wanted him on their side for this reason, and the security services were suspicious of him for the same reason. Now, I can tell you that there was a spy in the Institute of Archaeology in the 50s, but it wasn't Gordon Child. It was Anthony Blunt, who sat on the management committee of the Institute of Archaeology. And wouldn't all of us who work there now love to know what they used to talk about? And I'll leave you with this quote from Child, which is part of his very sad suicide letter. There is nothing more I want to do here, nothing I feel I ought and could do. I hate the prospect of the summer, but I hate more the fogs and snows of a British winter. Life ends best when one is happy and strong. Now, this is a very poignant personal suicide letter, but we have to put it in the context of other socialist suicide letters and attitudes. Now, Beatrice Webb, the eminent Fabian, suffered from depression for most of her life. And towards the end of her life, She writes repeatedly in her diary that she's desperate to commit suicide. And she feels this is the way forward. Like child, she's of no use to society anymore. But her love for her husband means that she can't leave him. And ironically, she does die before him. So he even ends his life in this kind of socialist idea that he's of no longer use to society. So he's decided to end when he's well, happy and strong. That's it. Thank you.
This podcast is copyright to the National Archives, rights reserved. It is available for reuse under the terms of the Open Government License.